When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
History in Five Songs with host Martin Popoff, a production of Pantheon Podcasts. Let's rock out with Martin.
Hello once again, and welcome back to another episode of History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff, brought to you by the good people at Pantheon Podcasts. We are a vast and always expanding bunch of wise music swamis. We are available on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, over 40 other podcast platforms. All right, this is episode 238. I'm calling this a different kind of genius. Why? Well, this is a follow-up episode on 237, which was just called Genius. And as I got to the end of that episode, there were a few people I wanted to talk about that I didn't quite feel fit into what we were talking about. And there were some interesting points to be made, and they all kind of were of a group. And that's what we have here, a different kind of genius. So, these people, variously, we're going to go over whether how much I think they are literally a genius or not in the music field. It's pretty interesting. A buddy of mine, Robert Lawson, said this too. I'll probably go through these comments on the Facebook page, but he echoed what I had said. Let's see if I could find his real quick. No, I can't. But anyways, he echoed what I said about this idea of being really strict using the word genius in the context of a rock star boob, you know, just like a rock star, you know, a caveman out there making rock and roll music, this horrible rock and roll music, right? So yeah, the idea. And I kept it like that as well. And as I mentioned, you know, people started mentioning names that I thought, there's no way we have to consider these people genius. Anyways, so that episode was about actual geniuses. And what we've got here is this subset of guys that I thought ascribed to this very specific idea of surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, people who will tell you what they think without regard for offending your sensibilities or treasured opinions. Now, that back part of it, I'm not so sure about. Who knows what goes on in a room? Who knows who has egos, right? But the main point with everybody we're going to talk about here is the idea that they seek out quiet geniuses, unknown geniuses. They unearth treasures to vampirically, you know, have them for their own. You know, that's an exaggeration, but in some cases, maybe it is like that. But no, these are guys that I don't think maybe on their own are geniuses. Although this first one maybe so, but the idea is that their sheer level of genius is the strategic genius, the smarts. And the striving to want to be so creative that they surround themselves with, you know, in some cases, just armies of super smart music swamis, the best in their field. You know, as we talked about a little bit in the Genius episode, because some of those guys, if you're a player going into a situation like a Snowy Shaw going into a black metal band, or an Adrian Belew going into Talking Heads, David Bowie, Frank Zappa, you almost feel like their confidence is just quiet and rock hard and high, that they're walking in there saying, I'm just as good or better than this absolute superstar here. But I'm just going to go in and do my job, right? I have a certain craft. He knows it. I know it. I'm going to go in and do this job. And I know I can do an incredible job. And if I was an artist on my own, I'd be doing as good a job as that person. I just don't happen to be as famous. There's kind of that attitude, I think, with these guys, and these big rock stars know that as well. they are smart enough to know that maybe they aren't even the smartest person in the room. And certainly they aren't the smartest person in the room when they picked, against that person that they picked to be a specialist on that instrument or what they bring to it, or production, or conceptualization, whatever, right? They know that these people that they assemble to do these jobs have these very specific skills, and they just very smartly put all the chess pieces in place to do this. Interesting thing I wanted to mention as well, I went and made up a list. I just cut and pasted from Podbay, I think it was Podbay I used, or Amazon. Anyways, you know how we have the 5 song clips all the time? I made this big, long master list of all 236 episodes, or 7 at that point, and stuck in all the song clips. And I've been sending that out to my database of book buyers, so everybody's got a copy of that, or a long list of things, or the episodes like without the song stripped in. So I stuck both in there. But the point is I can now go through and see if I've used a song clip before, and it's pretty interesting. So I did that with this one and made sure that none of these. I didn't check a couple of them, but I made sure on some of them that I did want to check that I didn't use the exact same track before. So it was pretty interesting. So anyways, let's go into our first selection here. Take a listen to this. This is Peter Gabriel with The Family in the Fishing Net. Okay, so love this album to death. The Security album is probably his most iconic in terms of like a unified sound. It's the sound he was building on Melt, but he gets to this. So Peter Gabriel, I definitely feel fits in this category. And he's one, well, you know, there's actually more here too, but at least a couple. But I'm going to say that that Peter Gabriel, I could almost stuck him in the Genius episode, right? But he is great at this as well. He is great at, finding the right people, assembling the people to put out his vision. Now, I didn't want to include anybody in this episode who I thought was just along for the ride, not doing the work, not even leading the thing, but being swept up in the whole thing, or even being like down into the equal zone. I wanted everybody here to be the driver of the vision, absolutely the boss, and not feeling intimidated at all, and literally wanting these people to get the sounds in his head down on tape, kind of thing, right? Peter Gabriel early on, he's got Robert Fripp in there, he's got Steve Hunter and Dick Wagner, so we've got these session guys that are known to do this. Tony Levin. So essentially, what happens, which I find the most interesting here, is that he's always got a ton of producers and programmers and classical people, but as he moves along, he pretty much realizes that he's got a couple of these quiet geniuses, treasures in their own field, such as Larry Fast on synthesizers and Jerry Murata on very, innovative kind of drums, who's eventually replaced by Manu Kachete. Did I pronounce that right? David Rhodes on very futuristic guitar. Did I mention Tony Levin? Yeah, Tony Levin on, stick bass and fretless, just fretless, and like such a cool sound. So he goes through these different mere mortals and arrives at this idea where he realizes he's smart enough to know that he is the boss. It's his name on the tin. He's singing all this stuff, and he's bringing all these iconic different voices, and he's a keyboardist, and he's conceptually, everything here is he's creating this mood, this environment that is very Peter Gabriel-esque. Like I say, starts in a big way on the third album. And then it's hugely there on Security, and then it's starting to wane or starting to change into something a little different. I think So, Us, Up, that whole thing is kind of a set. But what he realizes is that that these people, I would say especially a Jerry Murata, a Tony Levin, And yeah, Larry Fast. Although I know Peter Gabriel, you know, Peter is very involved in all of that end of it as well. But he realizes that these people are as much a part of the Peter Gabriel sound that he is, and his ego is. Well, I don't know where his ego is, but he's smart enough to know that that this great product that they put out is not all due to him. That he's got these great people along the way, and it's pretty interesting how you know, the lineup stays pretty solid, except for the, like I say, the armies of players who are bringing in ideas, who are teaching him things, who are keeping him creatively fired, right? But it's pretty much the same on So and Us and Up, and even all the way up into I.O., he's got some of the same people on there, right? And I think that album, I don't know, something about it is rubbing me the wrong way. It's sounding like a very, almost like a commercial, easy listening version of the So Us Peter Gabriel. It's kind of odd. I'm not sure quite what to think of it yet, but I think it's pretty cool that he keeps these people, but he's got the armies as well. All right, let's take a short break and we'll be right back. All right, back again here, History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff. Episode 238, A Different Kind of Genius. Take a listen to our second track and we shall discuss. This is King Crimson with Three of a Perfect Pair. All right, Three of a Perfect Pair. That little passage of music is my favorite piece of King Crimson music of all time. I just love that. I love what the bass is doing. It's so incredibly groovy. But yeah, that chorus of Three of a Perfect Pair is my favorite King Crimson music. That's from the third album, from the Red, Blue, Yellow period, third and last, March 1984. So we are talking about Robert Fripp here. What kind of genius is Robert Fripp? I would, again, be inclined almost to just call him a musical genius, period, anyways. I could have shoved him back into episode 237 and said, Robert Fripp, let's celebrate Robert Fripp. But I feel there's kind of a weirdness to him. There's obviously the sort of prickliness of his personality. There's the eclectic... that you don't want to call it genius, but you want to call it magic in some way. The things that he does on guitar, he's got the traditional thing that you hear a fair bit through the albums, but he's also got the Frippertronics thing, and he's got that really cool burbly soloing style. I was just on with a good buddy of mine, Daniel Bosch. We went through for his channel, went through David Bowie's Scary Monsters, and I was just extolling again how Teenage Wildlife is my favorite. Robert Fripp performance ever. But yeah, the crazy thing is, the reason I kind of want to put him in this episode is because he is just part of this freight train of this band with all these other people. And I'd say even less so than Peter Gabriel. And obviously, you know, the name on the tin is King Crimson. It's not like Peter Gabriel where it's a person's name. I feel like he's less of driving the entire thing that a Peter Gabriel would be on his albums, and he's got all these strong presences. You know, Mel Collins. You know, you go back to the fact that there's a lot of instrumentation that is foreign to Robert Fripp. I mean, you know, as a guitarist, obviously, but it's not guitar, bass, and drums. So there's all these kind of classical, jazzy, kraut rock arrangements all over the place too. But yeah, you've got later on, you've got Pat Mastelotto and Gavin Harrison. So you've got some of the greatest drummers of all time as part of the thing. You've got Peter Sinfield in on lyrics. You got Michael Giles on drums. Ian McDonald, you know, in the same role as a Mel Collins kind of thing. Different lead vocalists, Gordon Haskell, who plays bass as well, Ian Wallace. You know, Bill Bruford at one point is in there with Jamie Muir. You know, Jamie and Bill are both completely distinctive drummers. So, you know, I guess to back into, you know, the definition of this thing. So this is Robert Fripp wanting to work with the greatest in their field, right? In this thing, people who are are as creative and as fearlessly creative as he is, and want to just create this massive almost train wreck. You know, in certain respects, there's train wrecks on the 70s stuff, and there's train wrecks after the red, blue, yellow period as well. But these great cacophonies of sound, maybe abstract sound, maybe industrial sound, that Robert Fripp is just in there as one of the guys. And I almost want to use as a metaphor to what I think Robert Fripp's role is, in the fact that he's sitting down. That's kind of an interesting thing as well. So on stage, there's a lot of people, number one, you know, a couple of drummers, whatever. I mean, a lot of people. And he is just sitting down there, kind of looking around, bemused, with that sort of blank stare on his face, you know, the odd smirk, the odd smile. And he just realizes that he's got a lot of really important puzzle pieces. He's basically playing with kings and rooks and bishops, kind of thing, right? Kings, queens, rooks, bishops, horsies, you know, whatever. But it's like everybody's important. That's kind of the point here. So yes, he is surrounding himself with super smart people all the time, kind of thing. John Wetton, we know he was part of the thing as well. Boz Birrell, who goes on to Bad Company. That's pretty cool. So yeah, there we go. That's King Crimson. Let's play our third selection here. Take a listen to this. This is Robert Plant with Come Into My Life. And I'm straightened up, review my disposition, pour the hope back in my eyes I thought I lost so long ago. Come into your life. Okay, so now it subtly shifts here. So what I think you get with a Robert Plant is, I think out of the three guys we have so far, he's the least talented. He's the least genius out of all these guys so far. You know, he doesn't play an instrument. He writes really cool lyrics, and he's a singer. But, you know, really good lyrics, as we discussed in the last episode. I don't even want to put Bob Dylan in the genius category, because I'm really even harder on calling anybody a literary genius. And I don't think I'd call anybody a literary genius, or just a genius just because of the words they write, sort of thing. But yeah, Robert Plant, I got to tell you this, man, go back and read a lot of his lyrics. They are way better than he gets reputation for. He's a damn good lyricist. Anyways, so his big level of genius is absolutely perfect for this episode. It is really surrounding himself with communicatively with people who are smarter than he is, people who will tell you what they think without regarding or offending your sensibilities. Now, I think what Robert wants, the interesting thing he wants along the way, is he wants youth, fresh ideas. And as time goes on, as we know, he gets into this really interesting sort of conceptual thing of like, what if I made old-timey music, but I don't necessarily always, he does a lot of covers, but I don't necessarily have to cover things. But when we write things, I want them even to sound old. And I want the recording techniques to sound old. And I want old traditional instruments, but even if it's new traditional instruments, I want to use all the technology available to make it sound like it came out of 1830, right? So that's kind of what he gets into. But early on, famously, we've got Robbie Blunt, who comes up from that Bronco and Home thing, kind of a nobody, but then he just absolutely distinguishes himself across those couple of albums. We've got Phil Collins in there helping. We know he's a big presence. We got Jez Woodruff, a great keyboardist, was on in Sabbath as well. And not officially, but you know what I mean. Brings in Cozy Powell, brings in Barrymore Barlow. He eventually replaces his drummers with Richie Hayward. So he thinks, oh, I'm gonna combine this absolutely Devo-esque, very forward-thinking synthesizer music, and I'm gonna bring in the Little Feat drummer, right? So that's really cool. Then we're into this, a bunch of unknown guys, Phil Johnston, Doug Boyle, Phil Scragg, Chris Blackwell, Phil Scragg gets replaced by Charlie Jones. This is your Now and Zen Manic Nirvana period. later on. So yeah, Come Into My Life, I wanted to play because we're into the Great Fate of Nations album, May 25th, 1993. And I wanted to play one of the two tracks with the great Francis Dunnery on them. I've got piles of Francis Dunnery solo albums. Love the guy to death. But he's in there along with Kevin McMichael from Cutting Crew, sadly no longer with us. But then we get into this whole John Baggett, Porl Thompson, Justin Adams, Charlie Jones, Clive Deamer. We're moving through this now he's smart enough to even realize that these geniuses he has with them deserve a band name. So they're the Strange Sensation, then they're the Sensational Space Shifters. Some of the same guys, Leon Skin Tyson's up there. We got Joel De Camara, Billy Fuller, Dave Smith. So as we move on, there's again this army of people that nobody's ever heard of. You know, you got Band of Joy, where he's working with the Nashville people. He works with Alison Krauss. So the point here is that Robert Plant is perfect at this. He realizes he's coming into the situation. I think he even knows more than these other guys that that even him. In a big band with a bunch of members, I think he probably has a little bit of, let's not take it too far, but let's not say imposter syndrome, but he appreciates when someone can play their instruments well, and he is cognizant that he doesn't do that, right? So he's arranging all these parts. He's part of a band. He loves being part of a band. We know he'll jump on stage and jam with people, right? Which is really cool. But he's got this vision. But I think he's even less so than, or definitely less so than Peter Gabriel. He's got this vision, but he really needs a lot of people to put this together. You almost think Peter Gabriel, given time, and he takes a lot of time anyways, but given time, he could probably do most things himself and come up with that vision. I don't think Robert Plant feels that way, but he loves that he has a vision and he can get these people together and make this this old-timing, who do I always call old-timing, right, guys? The band in Creedence Clearwater Revival, right? But he can make this... He can make this, or Tom Waits, right? It's a little Tom Waitsy. He can make this old-time music because he's smart enough, he's genius enough to go find the best people to work with. All right, let's play our fourth selection here. Take a listen to this. This is Bjork with Black Lake. Man, I love this. I might have mentioned this before, but I, on a trip to New York, I went to the MoMA and there was a massive Bjork display on, and they were playing the video to this. This is a 10-minute song off of Volnakara, January 20th, 2015. So we're a few albums ago now. With a pretty good sound system, but a big video screen and a darkened room, the only thing in that room. And I watched that thing like 3 or 4 times. It was so powerful, right? This great, great video. You should check it out on YouTube. It's an amazing video. This is her big, distraught breakup album, right? But yeah, so going through just some of the latest albums, and I'll sort of explain where I'm going with this. Biophilia, 2011, produced by English dubstep duo 16-bit with Bjork. Volnakarna Volnakira. So Volnakira. I always get that. Anyways, produced by Bjork and Arca. This is a female Venezuelan electronic music record producer. And the Haxan Cloak, who is a guy. It's Bobby Kurlick, known by his stage name, the Haxan Cloak. British composer, artist, music producer, musician. I'm going somewhere with this. You look at Bjork, some of these albums as we move through them. We got Utopia 2017, which is basically... Bjork and Arca, and Fasara 2022. Features American singer Serpent with Feet, Bjork, two children, Sindra and Isadora, Indonesian dance duo, Gabber Modus Operandi, bass clarinet, sextet, Murmuri. So she is so artsy and so artistic, right? That even it's almost amusing reading her credits on these albums. But so it's essentially it's usually the case because she's quite an electronic artist, right? So, but electronic with a lot of classical. So it's usually the case that what you get with Björk is you get Björk, you get this major Swiss Army knife producer, keyboardist, synthesizer, conceptualizer with Björk. And then you often get these choirs of people from Iceland or little, you know, classical quartets, sextets, whatever, bunch of classical people, interesting instruments. So it's like three things: Björk, the futuristic stuff, and the old folk stuff, right? All mixed together and making these amazingly layered, huge albums. So again, This is a slightly different dynamic to all of them so far. This is almost like Björk working with a small team and then this massive enlarged team that's not really the band, right? Kind of thing. So it's like she's making these duo trio albums, and then there's this army of people all around that do things. So pretty interesting. And then also with Björk, so much of it is wrapped up in the video presentation as well. So she's working with all those people. So again, this is Björk making herself an extraordinary artist, but doing it by just seeking out quietly the most creative people on the planet to collaborate with. And that's what makes her so amazing. And it is kind of what Peter Gabriel's doing it. But once you get to Björk from Peter Gabriel, you're almost seeing, you're just going up into this impossibly artsy, snobby world that even you thought Peter Gabriel is like that, or King Crimson. No, Björk is on a whole nother level, right? This is like the most distilled version of creativity that you can sort of possibly imagine. All right, let's move on to our fifth selection here. This is David Bowie with Love Is Lost. Power of dread, darkest hour, and your voice is new. Love is lost, lost is love. All right, so this is from The Next Day, his second to last album, March 8th, 2013. This is literally my favorite David Bowie song from all of those later albums, which are amazing. Put it this way, this is my favorite David Bowie song pretty much moving forward from Scary Monsters, which is my favorite David Bowie album. So from 1980 all the way to the end. Love this song to death. It's really cool, sinister, dark. Another thing, this might be a whole episode. I don't even know how I'm going to articulate this, but it's David Bowie. This song and a lot of David Bowie songs, and like Morrissey, I'm like flabbergasted with the idea of what kind of music is this, right? It's really interesting how him and Morrissey make this really conservative music that you've never heard anywhere else before. So I don't know. Wrap your head around that one. Tell me if I'm making sense. But of course, we know Bowie, has gone through all of these different eras, and I think you really get that sort of vampire drawing energy thing from Bowie. I think Bowie is very much like a Peter Gabriel situation, where he just knows he can do some extraordinary work if he just goes and seeks out wherever they may be, no matter how famous they are or aren't. He doesn't care. He's almost happier if they're not famous. And find these people and collaborate with them. And I think that goes with producers as well. Of course, Tony Visconti has always been very important to this whole thing. But then all these names, these boring sounding names of these bands. It's a funny thing with Bowie, but you've got Mike Garson on keyboards, you've got Dennis Davis on drums, Carlos Alomar, George Murray on bass. So you've got all these people who have been around for a lot of albums and done some really extraordinary sounding things. But then of course you've got Adrian Belew on Lodger, you've got Robert Fripp doing some of his greatest work on some of these songs, Heroes and whatnot, right? Along the way, you get Brian Eno's a big part of things as well with synths and production and stuff in those Berlin years. You've got Stevie Ray Vaughan plays with him for a bit. Peter Frampton plays with him for a bit. Iggy Pop is involved, right? So there's all of these interesting sort of... Did Iggy actually... Hang on. Is Iggy literally doing anything on Bowie albums, or is it only vice versa? I can't remember now. All along the way, you get all sorts of... you get horn sections, you get strings. So he really, we got Gail Ann Dorsey. She's super important along the way as well. You've got getting together with the Sales Brothers for Tin Machine. So David Bowie definitely is one of these guys. Again, he fits perfectly this concept of, is he a genius on his own or would he be? I don't know. But you get to the end of this great, long, extraordinary life and career, and he's made some of the greatest albums of all time. Super creative. But when I considered him for the last episode, I go, is he a genius on his own? I don't know. I think the theme of this episode is these all of these people are sort of over half most of the way there to being a genius, and then they go right over the top and they even beat most of our geniuses because of how great they are as collaborators. So that's kind of the whole idea here. A couple others I kind of thought that, you know, I almost kind of put Steven Wilson in here as well. I think he kind of fits. But the reason I didn't put him in is credit to him. I think he is... probably, if you lined him up against all of the people we just talked about, he is closer to being a genius and doing most of the heavy lifting than most of these people are. I noticed my screen on my other computer has gone dark here. It's gone into sleep, so I'm not going to read these comments. Plus, we're at the end, but I just wanted, from memory, I can't remember who it was, but someone made a great case for Tom Waits as belonging in the genius episode. There were a lot of points. Go check out our Facebook page. Was Pete Townsend brought? I think someone brought up Pete Townsend, and I initially kind of dismissed him in that whole thing, but then I started thinking about all the synthesizer stuff, the conceptual stuff, you know, the early work with loops, the things like Lifehouse that he didn't get to do. So Pete Townsend's kind of close as well. And one that's a little off the path that I thought might fit this episode a little bit, but would be different from all of these, because I think everybody I picked here lines up really nice, is Alice Cooper. With his, I wouldn't say Alice Cooper on his own is any sort of genius, but he's been really smart with surrounding himself with positive young people who are really professional and do their job well. But that's kind of different. I mean, you know, Alice Cooper is not trying to write masterpieces in the same way that these people that we've talked about here are. And come to think of it, out of the five we've talked about, I think Robert Plant is not trying to write masterpieces either. We've talked about what he's trying to do, but no, Alice doesn't fit in that, but he's like a genius at life. I've talked about his life, and you go through the whole thing and you do the timeline, as I've done, on everything he's accomplished, and he's packed in more living than I think anybody I can think of outside, maybe Paul McCartney, right? Anyways, there you go. That's episode 238, A Different Kind of Genius. If you like the show and want to support future episodes, please go to ko-fi.com/MartinPopoff. Hit that red support button and buy me a coffee or a pint. This week, I would like to thank Ron Bart Kowiak, Joe Becht, Marco Beck, Brandon Belt, Andy at Black Sugar Transmission, David Bottas, Jeffrey Coggins, Tony Kennedy, Brendan Jarvis, Matt LeGros, John Olson, Augustine Garcia DiPrete, Steve Polari, Dan Rosenson, Martin Sechan, and John Stuckey. Thank you all very much. You can go to martinpopoff.com for all your book needs. You can check out our video channel, The Contrarians, and you can hear me on Sea of Tranquility with my good buddy Pete Pardo every Friday morning. That's it for now. Please go over to the Facebook page. Tell me who else fits this collaborative genius category and who else fits the true genius category.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.